It is Friday, May 27, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on our program, after a spot of geek news, we're speaking about Make Magazine's Volume 2. This wonderful magazine brought to us by O'Reilly is stuffed full of yummy, geeky projects to do at home. And, of course, we have Philip Terone, who's an associate editor for Make Magazine, joining us. That'll be in about 15 minutes. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, technical trainer for Surf Control, and Drew Mayer, storage specialist at AdaptTech. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get in our discussion on Make Magazine, let's do some geek news. Drew, let's start with you.
So, let's see. An interesting thing was just discovered here locally, a flower that was thought to be extinct from Mount Diablo and is endemic to Mount Diablo. It has been found nowhere else in the last 69 years. It has been rediscovered by a Berkeley graduate student who was hiking out there. And so this is it's called the...
Did he
Mount,
pick it?
No, he didn't pick it. The Mount Diablo buckwheat. It's actually, there's a cluster of them, and he was shocked to find them and astonished at his luck, and he's not released where the location is to prevent people from going and accidentally maybe trampling them or picking them in their ignorance. So it's a thrill for plant enthusiasts and conservationists, and it's an example of how the really cool stuff can be happening right under your nose, I'd say.
Thank you, Drew. Miles?
A milestone was reached. Voyager 1 has... broken past interstellar space, past the region known as the termination shock. The solar system works kind of like the gravity well of the sun works as a bow of a ship, as it were, through interstellar space. And so as a ship passes through the ocean, you have those waves in front of the front of the ship. The same thing happens with the solar system. And Voyager 1 is now the first... artificial, you know, device that has passed beyond this point.
Are we still getting contact from it?
Yes. Well, that's how we actually know that, okay. It is at that point. But
I guess that's a good point, huh? It told us that it was there, so we believe it.
It's really sitting playing badminton or something.
But it was saying that the solar wind seemed to slow down from a top speed of just over 2 million kilometers per hour.
Ah, slow down.
Yes.
2 million kilometers per hour?
Yeah, 8.7 billion miles from the sun. And
wow.
That's twice the distance from the sun to Pluto.
Wow. That's a long way.
So it's twice as far. Wow. Yeah, I can't even. I mean, I really don't get it. That's a long way.
That's a long way. Thank you, Miles. Drew, back to you, my man.
Let's see. The CIA is running a cyber war game this week designed to test how effective information systems would be in withstanding an orchestrated hacking attack. It's called Silent Horizon. It seems like a reasonably creative name. It's based on an imaginary attack on U.S. systems by a fictional coalition of terrorists or anti-globalization or protesters, unhappy people. And it's set 5 years in the future. Previous exercises have demonstrated that systems are pretty robust, but there are still remains a lot of concern about an electronic Pearl Harbor, if you will, where somebody comes and surprise attacks the systems, and then the whole system goes down, and this is a design to prevent against that. So go U.S. government, go CIA, right?
All right, so the war games basically for hacking, or for cracking, I should say.
Yeah, and now, you know, you got to wonder if the guy who designed the cyber war game, he's probably worth a lot of money to the terrorists.
You think?
He knows all the back doors.
Well, thanks for that. Miles?
I've heard people say in the past, you know, what good are particle accelerators, just some esoteric thing that physicists use, you know, to pass the time. But in fact, a particle accelerator is being used to reveal the long-lost writings of the Greek mathematician Archimedes, a work hidden for centuries after a Christian monk wrote over it in the Middle Ages.
So what does the particle accelerator have to do with reading?
Because they emit X-rays, and the X-rays cause the iron in the hidden ink to glow.
So no way.
That's great.
So we can read what's underneath this overwritten stuff?
Yes.
What does it say?
That is still being looked at and still being analyzed, and I actually don't speak ancient Greek. I think
I think there's a lot of amazing uses that have come out of particle accelerators. Sure, that's kind of put it as a more tangible for people, being able to read stuff that's been erased, but come on.
Right.
Like,
I don't know.
Science frontier has been driven by...
Oh, yes, I totally agree. At the same time, folks, when they're talking about building larger and larger particle accelerators and making, you know, things like that, you hear people say, like, well, that's just random, you know, science. Like, what practicality? How's it going to improve my life on a daily basis? Now, then again, you know, like, being able to see Archimedes, but at the same time, exposing writings that may have been lost.
Right.
That is a piece of our history, of our culture.
I've got something that really improves the quality of life today. It's a recipe for free beer. Well, it's a recipe for beer, I should say, but it's been released under an open source license. So that anybody who wants to can go get this beer recipe, download it, create the brew, publish the changes or improvements that they've made back to the community, and earn money from creating this new flavor of beer or this new species or whatever you want to call it.
So it's a good thing you published it, because before that, no one could make beer.
Well, it's kind of like what do you want to stick under the particle accelerator, this old document or your thumb? You know? It's just for the sake of doing it, and I think it's an interesting exercise in intellectual property. So now you can go download a beer recipe from the folks in Berlin, brought to you by the open source community.
Thank you very much, Drew. Miles, I'm going to wrap up the news with you. Your last story, sir.
Oh, my last story?
Well, maybe one. No, your last one. Drew, just
okay.
One more.
Okay, all right, fine. Airport screeners can see X-rated X-rays. One of the things being pushed for with the Department of Homeland Security and airports is a device to be able to see underneath clothing and see different weapons and paraphernalia that you may be carrying. This is in response to some recent bombings on Russian airlines fairly recently. However, of course, you have a lot of outrage from privacy groups saying, you know, for example, people aren't too keen on, for example, being strip searched.
Oh, I am.
Okay.
That's fair.
No, that's true.
But right? At the same time, you know, this is what this is talking about, being able to see a grayscale image of the human body down to, you know, the finest detail.
Right, without irradiating the person.
Right.
All right.
Well, it's a very low power.
Would you support this if it was quick?
No.
Why not?
Why not? You're already getting searched.
I mean, you're traveling all the time. You're flying all the time.
Yes, because efficiency is not a good excuse for getting rid of essential privacy and civil liberty.
Right on. Thank you for that, Miles. I appreciate that. Now, you remember that when you're standing in line today for 2 hours to get on a plane.
Okay, I have to say, traveling, it's kind of a hassle, and I really do miss the days when I could have met, you know, family members and friends
at the gate. Yeah, that's huge.
But at the same time, I haven't had that big of a problem getting through the security.
Good.
It's been drop the laptop into the bin, drop your...
That's because you got an innocent-looking face, Miles.
Some would say boyish.
Oh, childish.
Since this is radio, you'll never know the difference.
There are pictures of Miles online.
That's
Miles,
right.
Actually, I have a boil on my nose.
Because of all our jokes palette, and laughter, I'm not going to do another news story. Sorry, Drew. We're going to go on to to a wonderful magazine by O'Reilly, Make. Volume 2 just got to me yesterday, and I was like, we're doing the show tomorrow on it. So, okay, Make magazine. I don't know. I pick it up, and I, like, flip through the pages rapidly and let my baby cry while I'm reading it. That's how good a magazine it is. Okay, I don't really do that. In any case, it's got a lot of wonderful articles. And in March, we had Philip Tyrone on to talk about the magazine's launch and some of the articles that were going on. And we've asked him to come back again, and he has graciously accepted our invitation. And Philip, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Philip, Associate Editor, Make Magazine, and you've got this wonderful article, Podcasting 101. Philip, what's podcasting?
Well, podcasting is a term that, you know, people have been talking about a lot lately, and it's basically nothing really new. It's nothing that's... going to maybe change the world, but it puts together some neat pieces of technologies that we've had for a while. a podcast generally is an MP3 file, and we all know what MP3s are. We download them, and we put them on our iPods or music players or whatever. And there's also this other piece that lets you subscribe to a website or an audio program or any site that decides to offer up audio. And that's where the magic happens. And that's where you basically have an application running on your computer that goes and checks the website. And if there's a new audio program, it downloads it when you're not using your computer or at night or whenever. And then that goes on to your music player. And so the real neat part about this is it's all sorts of the content out there. It's coming from NPR. It's coming from Newsweek now. It's coming from ABC. It's coming from thousands and thousands of bloggers. And it basically gives the power of voice to a really big audience. So kind of like how blogs give everybody the printing press, well, podcasting kind of gives everyone their own radio station.
All right. And Drew, you had a question for me?
No, I think, in fact, we at GeekSpeak use podcasting as a method of distributing our content.
So it's technically kind of complicated, I mean, from a layman's perspective. But what your article does is kind of guides through someone to be able to make an iPod, or podcasting, I should say. Do you find that someone could pick up this magazine with having a little bit of computer experience and go with it and be able to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I purposely made the article approachable. Like if USA Today were to do an article on how to make a podcast, I think this would, you know, be very similar to it. In basically an afternoon, and with just about any computer, you can make an audio show. The tricky parts are at the end, when you want to upload it and get people subscribed to it. But basically, you know, you can download free open source audio software that can record. Most computers have a microphone input that you can plug a microphone into. And that's the main part of recording a show. You can add music. There's places to find free music that so you don't break any copyrights. We go over some editing, how to add things. If you want to interview people via Skype or iChat or your computer, we show you how to do that. And then you edit it and publish it out as an MP3 file on your system. And then after that, that's when things get a little complicated, but it's getting easier. So you need to get that file somewhere on the web. And once you upload that file somewhere on the web, you need to make an RSS feed, which is just a really technical way of saying a file that describes information about a file. And once you have that file, people can subscribe to it. Now, luckily, what's changing, which is really good, is there's a whole slew of web services that's going to simplify this a lot. So you could record an audio file pretty soon using a couple different services that aren't released yet, but they're going to get released soon. And once you record that file directly through your web browser, just you plug in your microphone and your web browser, actually it has a program running inside it, you can record. And that'll do all the hard work. It'll help you edit it. It'll get it on a server. It'll make the RSS feed and allow people to subscribe. But if you're interested in doing it yourself, you know, our
the magazine helps.
Our article has that.
Yeah, let's put this in perspective. What this means is the podcasting. What this really means for people is that the traditional on the soapbox in the town square speaking. Anyone can do that now online that has a computer and a microphone, and that basically allows a much larger audience, an audience that can find your content a lot later and at any time they want. So it's really wonderful for, like, self-publication. We happen to archive our show that way, but, of course, our main audience, of course, is through the Central Coast of California, through FM. But I'm finding that, you know, we're getting our shows downloaded maybe 500 times every show. So there's some other people that want to be able to listen to the show on the road or in a different area outside of California, and it's a great feature for that. But I think one of the strongest things is this idea that anyone can have a voice, and as long as you kind of notate it well and kind of talk about what you're doing in text, it's easy to find through search as well, through like a Google or Yahoo search. So very exciting stuff. If you're interested in podcasting, I wouldn't turn down the idea of grabbing Make Volume 2, which is on shelves like any day now, right?
Yeah, it's in Borders and it's in Barnes & Noble. You could subscribe through magazine.com and also on Amazon. And, you know, just going back to one thing you said, I actually got an email right before you guys called for this show. And a fellow said, hey, just to let you know, I'm an odd listener. I'm actually backpacking through Central and South America. And every once in a while, I manage to stumble upon an internet cafe and I download podcasts from all over the blog world. And I just wanted to let you know I've really, you know, been enjoying this podcast and that podcast. You know, keep up the good work. And when he gets back, he's going to pick up Make and hopefully make his own and talk about his experience. And I really think, you know, especially for your show, you know, you don't need to build a bigger tower. You know, you just put up a file, and I think that's it, and it goes along what you're saying about having this voice that can go in a lot of places. I look at my favorite science shows like Science Friday. They're actually converting from just having it behind the Audible firewall, essentially, where you had to pay to get Science Friday, and they're letting that content out, and they're putting it up as podcasts like a week after the shows. And so now, you know, people around the world will be able to learn more about science. So it works great for everybody. People have content that they already want to distribute, and then people who just want to start their own show. And it kind of goes along with that long tail term that we've all heard, where there's a lot of interesting little bits of content for everybody. And, you know, maybe this will help radio get more interesting, because if you listen to, you know, the rest of the dial that's, you know, your top 40 music, a lot of people are just starting to tune out on that. And so, you know, this might help everyone just get a little bit more creative. And it's all good for everybody, because we get to download it later if we miss it, too.
Now, speaking of creative, Make Magazine has a lot of, I mean, everything's about being creative. I like the Mousy, the junk bot. Can you tell us what that is, this project?
Well, the Mousy junk bot is interesting. On a side note, you know, you always kind of wonder what you're going to do with all your hardware around the house. That, you know, a mouse, what are you going to do with that old, you know, serial mouse or whatever? Well, the Mousy junk bot project is interesting. You can take some parts that you might have around the house, or just go to Radio Shack and pick up a couple little parts, and it turns a regular computer mouse that you dissect into a light-seeking robot that will run around. And I have one at the house, and I let it chase the dog around, and the cat chases it. And it's just a really neat project that you can build in a day, essentially.
With soldering iron.
What was that?
With a soldering iron.
Yeah, you need a soldering iron. It's pretty easy. I mean, it's kind of more along the lines of a beam robot, where you don't need a chip and programming it. All you need to do is get all the different parts and the resistors, and when you put it all together, that's the brains. If folks are interested in...
It uses an analog feedback. It doesn't have a microprocessor in it.
Yeah.
And basically what this is, you take, you know, the mice with a wheel in it, that's kind of the ones that are used because it looks cool. You basically take out the sensors, the optical sensors in it, and use those as its eyes so that it starts sensing light. And what that does is it feeds the direction of the mouse. So the mouse is going to go towards light. And then it has a little bumper in the front. And when the bumper gets hit, it turns around. And the mouse, of course, has no cord on it. It's got a 9-volt battery in it. And it's got two little motors that would come out of like a little toy motors. And it runs around pretty quick and scoots about and is a blast to play with. I'd love to build one. If I had time, I would be doing that. Let's go to the next project. This one is like Supreme Geek. The Atari. Can you tell us about the Atari game?
Yeah, the Atari 2600 one is interesting. You know, retro is kind of in. I guess it'll always be in. But let's say if you have that old Atari 2600 that's sitting in the basement, well, what can you do with it? Well, it turns out you can actually turn it into a great PC case. And our how-to shows you how you can not only turn it into a PC case, but, you know, play DVDs, you know, run your TV through it, but also turn it into a retro computing device where you could run, you know, those old emulators and actually use the old joysticks and hardware to play the game. So it's a pretty in-depth how-to. I mean, we've got everything from, you know, mocking up design of where you're going to put your parts, configuring the BIOS, installing all the software, the control panel on the front to turn it on and off, and all those switches still work. Then, you know, you put a USB and FireWire card in the back, or the how it fits in the back, a keyboard and mouse receiver, and all those interfaces. And it's a pretty complicated project. But, you know, with Make, we have, I think this project is like, you know, 30 pages or so. So you definitely have every photo you need, every thing that you need for as far as the parts goes. And then we get into getting the most out of your retro PC and all the emulators from the NES ones to Atari to even, you know, putting a PlayStation 2 emulator on there.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Yeah, why not?
And this is a lot of work.
That. Yeah, this is hours of work. I mean, this is days of work.
Yeah.
Building this thing out
in order to get Atari 2600 games to play.
But it also is a DVD player, and it's a home entertainment system.
I see. And it's free when you start.
Well.
What's your time worth?
Yeah, what's your time worth?
It sounds like a great project.
Yeah. Philip, can you talk to us about this idea that a lot of people start off making projects because there's this perception that making it will be cheaper than buying it. I mean, this Atari thing you can't buy. I mean, unless you find someone else to make it for you. Mm-hmm. But what about in general this idea that making stuff, this kind of maybe false economy of do-it-yourself?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I think that a lot of people are kind of tired of the gadget lust. Like, if they were going to buy a great phone, they already bought it. If they were going to buy an MP3 player, they bought it already. If they were going to buy a digital camera, they got it. So they got all this stuff laying around. They also have a lot of old stuff. And, you know, we're all kind of environmentally sensitive. We're like, what are we going to do with this? Do we throw it out? Do we eBay it? Do we put it on Craigslist? What else can we do with this to get more out of it? And so that's kind of our mantra. We really like the idea of getting more out of the technology you already have. And these do-it-yourself projects, these are great. I mean, if you have an Atari 2600 and you're not using it, and you have an old PC that you want to remount into something else, you know, this is a great project for that. If you have an old mouse, you know, you can certainly, turn it into a robot. What a great project to do with kids. And so I think that's part of it. The other part is the thrifty nature of the magazine. In our first issue, one of the most popular articles kind of surprised us, but it's still making its way around the web, and we get emails about it all the time, is the $14 video camera stabilizer. Instead of paying the $10,000 for the professional version, you can make one out of $14 if you just know a little bit about physics and get some weights and get some things at the hardware store. And so I think there's a little bit of self empowerment where you can get something that's probably pretty good or close to what something, you know, costs you 10 or 100 times more. And along the way, you learn a lot. There's always a price tag on your time. But, you know, how often are you going to learn about circuitry and resistors and capacitors in your normal everyday life? Well, if you start making a robot, then, you know, this is a great way to learn.
Yeah. It's also this idea that you're going to enjoy the thing because you helped create it or you created it. I mean, you're going to have more attachment to it. Yeah. I want to talk about the recycled rubber because being broadcasting from Santa Cruz, we're a surf city, of course, and there are wetsuits everywhere. So what's this recycled rubber article?
Yeah, the wetsuits are interesting. In fact, I would say that anybody who has a wetsuit, you know, save it, and there's always great projects for it. The recycled rubber article we have is really neat. Saul Griffith wrote it, and it's a great way to make a laptop bag from an old wetsuit. So, you know, the neoprene is, or can be hand-stitched. It looks awesome when you put it together. And we have tips on where to find it, how to make the laptop bag. And when you see this, I was at a conference and Saul was there and he had it with him. It was so funny because people came up to him, and these are people who like buy laptop bags all the time. I mean, this is, you know, definitely a geek conference. And they're like, wow, that's the coolest laptop bag I saw. Where can I buy one? And he made it himself. And so I think that's just another great example of just taking something that you already have. You know, that material is great. It's you know, obviously it can handle water well. And putting it together is relatively easy. So I think that's another great example of you know, just doing more with something you might already have.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We are speaking with Philip Tyrone, Associate Editor of Make Magazine. We're talking all about making things yourself, the magazine. We can also answer general technical questions and comments. The phone numbers open now. 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877.
This Week in This American Life, an original radio play by David Sedaris in rhymed couplets about the place where dogs and cats and sparrows all go to resolve their differences.
I didn't do nothing. I'm just not the sort. I'll see you in hell first. Or animal court.
Animals and their animalness, real and imagined, Public Radio International.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Sorry to surprise you there, Drew.
No, whoa. May is California Museum Month, an annual event, and you are encouraged to visit a museum, science center, zoo, or botanical garden in your area. There will be over 100 diverse programs and events being held especially for this event. To learn about events in your area, visit www.calmuseums.org.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Miles left us already. He had to fly out of the state. But Miles Elam was here, and Drew Meyer is still here. And we are speaking with Philip Tyrone, Associate Editor of Make Magazine, all about making things yourself. You're welcome to join the conversation. Our conversation. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877 or visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us to get into our email inbox. Philip, thank you so much for being here and taking the time to do this. You're doing podcasting now, recording people, interviewing people. What are you finding the difficulties of doing that?
Well, the trickiest part is getting the recordings recorded. If you have a Mac or a PC and you use Skype or iChat or MSN or use any of the voiceover IP services, generally it's a little complicated to combine the audio input that's into your microphone and the audio output that's coming through the speakers in an easy way. Mm-hmm. Depending on your operating system or your particular setup or a sound card, things get really complicated. The other thing is when I'm talking to people, usually they won't install a piece of software for me to talk to them and record it. So I need to use my computer to record at the same time as making a phone call. So I've been experimenting with Skype and all the different voiceover IP services, and that's the challenge, I guess, is making all of that work. And I could plug into a telephone, I could get a soundboard, I could do all the things, but what I wanted to do is always make it so when I do something, I can document it, and just about anybody can use their computer to do the same thing. That's kind of the way I wanted to always approach it, because as soon as I start buying lots of equipment, I may as well just go and, put up a tower and do, a real radio thing. And instead, I wanted to have a system and a method and documentation on how anyone can use the power of a computer to
do that. All right, we got a call from Watsonville, Judith, Watsonville, California. Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, yeah. I have, I guess, actually a couple questions.
Well, one, go ahead and give us the first one.
The first one it has to do with, the MP3 files that are online.
Mm-hmm.
and downloading them. It's like, can you actually download them, or do you have to listen to them online?
You can download them. One of the simple ways to do that, what you'll see is a link to an MP3 file, and if you click on it, it will start playing automatically.
Uh-huh.
Are you on a Mac or a PC?
I'm on a Mac.
Okay. The control button on your keyboard, CTRL
uh-huh.
button, if you hold that down and click on the link instead of clicking on the link, hold down the control and click on the link, you'll see a little menu pop up. And one of the items is save linked file as.
Oh.
And you can save it.
Oh, great.
That works on most content. Some content doesn't work that way. The other way to do it is you can start the download process, and in the browser it'll show up. You're probably using Safari. In the browser it'll show up and it'll start playing. You'll see a bar that plays. You can go to File, Save at that point.
Oh.
And choose where you want to save it.
Oh, great.
What's your second question?
The second question has to do with, if you wanted to, record something. I have some old music that I've recorded on tapes, on cassette tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to transfer that into a a GarageBand file on the computer sort of directly? I have
Philip,
an iMic.
Philip, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, the best way, actually, I get this question a lot, is there's a little piece of equipment called the iMic. It's a Griffin product. They sell it at all the Apple stores.
I have that.
Oh, great. And so what you'll do is when you play your cassette or whatever, you have an audio out jack. And what you'll do is you'll get a cable at Radio Shack. I think it's a 3.5-millimeter audio cable. And what you'll do is you'll plug it from the output of the cassette player or whatever, normally where you'd plug in headphones, and you plug that into the microphone jack on the iMic device. And then you can open up GarageBand and go to Preferences and choose the iMic as the sound input, and you'll once you choose that, you'll be able to see the audio levels. Also, you can get a free tool called Audacity and record it. And there's a couple, if you do a Google search, there's actually a couple how-tos floating around on the web on how to do this.
You just said that you would have to record it through Audacity. You can't record through GarageBand?
No, you can do that as well. Yeah, okay. Either one of those will work fine.
I've tried that, and it doesn't seem to come through.
I think you probably need to set the right preference. GarageBand, by default, has like built-in microphone as the sound input, and you'll probably need to change it to iMic. And once you change that, you should be able to see the levels on one of the soundtracks in GarageBand when you start playing the music through.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good luck.
So isn't one of the reasons it's called podcasting is because you can stick it on your iPod? Or maybe I just made that up. I don't know.
Well, you know, there was kind of a land grab to coin a term when this started to happen. I mean, people have been recording MP3s and putting them online for years. I used to do a radio show in New York in, like, the early 90s, and, like, we were putting up real audio files because that was the format at the time. And so when the early pioneers of podcasting started to do things, they were just calling it audio or, you know, audio blogging. And then, someone called it podcasting. And the name just sort of stuck because unlike, you know, RSS or XML or a lot of, like, really hard terms, when you hear pod and cast, you automatically, okay, it's like broadcasting, but there's a pod involved, iPod, okay. It's a self-describing term, which is rare in technology, so I think that's why it stuck.
Got it.
There's a lot of complicating terms in technology. If you want to be clear on some of them, you're welcome to give us a call and ask. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You see how I tried to segue and it just sounded weird? That was interesting. Philip, let's talk about, since we're talking about music and GarageBand, one thing that's really clear about the recording the audio into the computer and setting the right preferences, once you do have that audio in GarageBand, it's not like it's going to open up and show you all the tracks of the music. It's going to be an audio file that you can't, like, change you can't take the drums out easily and stuff. So just to be clear on that, two different things. Okay, Tom Anderson and Wendell Anderson wrote a wonderful article on old amplifiers. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this old amp is a really neat article. It's well beyond my musical capabilities, but these guys are like old pros in the music space, and they build their own amps, and it's a really impressive project. If you're interested in vintage guitar amplifiers, like the Fenders and the Vox ones, you can buy those on eBay. But they actually show how to restore one of the old amps and make it sound, you know, as good or better as when they were new. And so, the first thing you got to do is get rid of the old capacitors, and then we have a circuit diagram on how to make new ones. Diagnosing, opening, and repairing the old amp, that's one of the things you'll need to do. So how to test it, how to find out how much voltage you're going through, and then getting new capacitors, and then basically repowering it and tweaking it in the way you want. And this is, you know, another one where we have all the diagrams, we have a lot of interesting step-by-steps, and there is, you know, some dangers in playing with electricity, and we kind of go through the safe ways of doing that.
Awesome. To be clear, we're talking about Make Magazine by O'Reilly. Volume 2 is just coming out on the shelves. It's all about do-it-yourself. Wonderful articles on being that way, I would say. Okay, we got another call from, I'm not sure where it's from, but it's Path. Welcome to GeekSpeak. Hello? Yes.
Hi.
Hi, you're on?
Great, thanks. I'm in a GarageBand, and the last caller, the second to last caller, referred to a program called GarageBand, and I'm wondering, is that something that's probably already in my PC, or do you go out and get that? Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Philip?
Yeah, well, GarageBand is actually a Mac application, and so, but that's okay. You don't necessarily have to use that to do music. There's a free tool called Audacity, Audacity, I guess I-C-I-T-Y. That's a free tool, and I suggest that, you know, before you ever spend any money on a professional level tool, try that because it's on par with those, and a quick Google search will find the tool for you. I think it's like audacity.soundforge.net or something.
Yeah, it's audacity.sourceforge.net. Yeah, it's great. It's a great tool for recording your music into. Do you record your GarageBand?
We try. We put it into a sound system, but the quality of the sound is never very good.
Right.
Except I should say that there's a couple of geeks in the group who are supposed to be doing it, and it's just never coming out any good. So I'm going to bring this new information, or see if it's new information or whatever.
It probably isn't. If they're getting stuff on, are they recording stuff on their computer?
There's a system at our rehearsals, there's a pretty major sound system that we all plug our mics and our guitars into, that is recording. But it's then they try to send something out to us on our computers, and that's where it sounds really bad.
They're probably making MP3 files that compress stuff and start sounding bad. Yeah, it's one of the problems. Good sounding audio takes a lot of space.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call. Good luck on recording your garage band. What's the name of your band?
Freedom Boulevard.
Thank you very much.
Okay, right, thank you. Bye bye.
Coming from Watsonville, it makes sense.
Could she possibly rent?
Yeah.
From down that area.
All right, the lines are open. You're welcome to call in with questions or comments about technology. We can handle anything.
Oh, man, if my friends are listening, we better watch out.
The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Now, when I say we can handle anything, we can handle any call, just that the answers might be, I don't know.
You get what you pay for with
that
GeekSpeak.
Right.
Hey, Philip, I have a question for you. How do you find people to contribute to the magazine that are out there producing stuff like this and get in touch with them? Because I know people are doing it in their garage, but how do they actually get to make magazine?
You know, it's interesting. For years, I think everybody at O'Reilly and certainly Mark and myself and Dale, we always have these collections of weird freaks far away. And I always try to work with people that are just really freaky, and usually they're in some country somewhere else, or they're in a different state or whatever. And I think because of the Internet and because of Google and because of just instant messaging and IRC and Skype and all these things just finally kind of coming together, it's funny how there's such an interesting network of people. Like, when I want to find out about robotics, there's through 2 degrees of separation, I can talk to someone who's working on the next generation of Roombas, just because of the way everything is so highly networked. And everyone who's involved in these things are always on email. They're always out there. And so a lot of it is just, friends.
Uh-huh.
We all kind of know each other. And the other thing is you just kind of run into people now, and it's odd. It's almost like, in the Matrix, where they kind of find you. Like, there's Morpheus out there, and you just get the phone call one day. But it's a tight-knit community of people, and they're all gravitating towards each other. And so with Make, someone asks, like, do you have a hard time filling up, 200 pages an issue? It's like, we wish we could, do 500 pages an issue.
I bet. It's a solid little book, and it's got an article every couple of pages.
Yeah.
There's no ads. It's great.
Yeah, it's hard to find any ads in this. It's meaty, and when you compare it to every other magazine on the newsstand, it's hard to tell if there's even content in the magazines anymore. So we really like that we're, very content heavy. It's a really meaty magazine with just, it's back to back and page to page of articles and content and how-tos.
And clearly there's a demand, right? Because this thing's just getting bigger, and this is the second release. So people are subscribing?
Yeah, I think I know we passed the 25,000 subscriber mark. I think that's what's being reported now, and I know that we passed that a while ago. We've been floating in the top 10 of Amazon magazine subscriptions. We were number one for a while, but then, people beat us, of course,
Sure.
Skinny Lindsay Lohan photos, I guess, will always beat us. But we're not opposed to having her do an article eventually. I don't know what she'd write about. But people and Maxim will surpass us, occasionally. But we're usually in the top 10, which is really encouraging to me, because it means we've got a chance of, science and engineering and fun and robotics kind of, coming back into, the daily conversation.
Right on. Thank you for doing that. Please.
All right. The phone lines are almost all open. We do have one call we're about to go to. You're welcome to join us. Ask us about anything you'd like, about technical problems you might be having, hard drive failure, whatever. 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're talking with Associate Editor of Make Magazine, Philip Tyrone, about this wonderful magazine. Volume 2 is on the shelves now. We're going to take a call now from Tim. Tim, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, we lost Tim. Well, Tim was on a cell phone, so maybe he'll call us back. While we're waiting, I'd like to give you the opportunity, Philip, to talk about the broadcast flag.
Right. Well, the broadcast flag. A little bit of history about the broadcast flag. If folks are familiar with it, or whether they're not familiar with it, doesn't matter. Basically, the media companies got together and said, hey, we need to figure out a way to control the content. We kind of lost the battle with CDs. People can put it on their iPods. We wish there was a way to. So they couldn't do what they wanted to do with their music. How about we figure out a way to do something with television broadcasts, and let's start bolting our ideas and what we want to do onto HDTV. And they went to the FCC, all the big media companies, and said, okay, FCC, here's the thing. We're not going to – we don't want to release our high-definition content unless you can guarantee, like, people won't be able to copy it easily. And so they came up with this thing called the broadcast flag. Now, they kind of lied because they still released their HDTV content, and they still put it out there. But what happened was the FCC said, okay, all right, we'll make this thing, this broadcast flag thing, and it's actually they actually started telling people who make devices, you have to put in a little listener for when the content can't be copied. And so when you think about it, this is not really good. I mean, we've had the freedoms of the VCR for years and years and years, and we've been able to copy TV shows. But basically, the broadcast flag might make it so you couldn't do that. You wouldn't be able to transfer something from your video recorder onto DVD if you wanted to save it, you know, and there's a lot of reasons they want to sell you the season of Sopranos on DVD, but what if you wanted to record it and just, you know, keep it on your video recorder? And so the broadcast flag came around. Now a lot of people challenge it, and the EFF, which is a great organization that's always fighting for our rights and privacy and electronics and all that, decided to go after the FCC and say, hey, you know, that doesn't that you can't you guys are not responsible for mandating how hardware is designed. You can't do that. And eventually a court and a judge said, yeah, you know, you guys actually can't just tell people how they design hardware, because what would happen is if you do any open source project, or if you design hardware, or if you want to make anything that goes near a television in the future, you need to get permission to build it. And that's bad for innovation. You know, if people right. could ask permission, if they had to ask permission for every single time someone made something, the iPod would never come out, and, you know, anything would never come out, because right. the people would just not, who own all this stuff, would just say, no, it can record, this is bad. So there's good news and bad news. So it got struck down. It doesn't look like that it's happening immediately. July 1st was going to be when all the equipment had to start basically listening for this flag. Now, the bad news, here it is. So, of course, when the FCC is told they don't have the authority to do that, the media conglomerates and other people who want this get together and say, okay, well, let's go to Congress and we'll get a law passed. So the FCC does have mm-hmm. the ability to mandate hardware. And so we got to fight this. And I encourage everyone to go to EFF.org and look at the broadcast flag information there. This will really break our TVs. This will make it really bad for all of us. And, you know, just keep an eye on it, because this is probably one of the worst things that can happen to television and to electronics, I think, you know, at least in the last, you know, 10 years, I think.
Okay.
We all got to watch.
Thank you, Philip. We're going to go ahead and start taking calls now. Tim came back on a cell phone. Tim, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yep. Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Yeah, I have a wireless network in my house, 802.11b, an airport system, uh-huh. running Mac. 10.4 on all of these computers. I've got an iMac that's wireless. I've got a laptop that's wireless, and then I've got a G4 that's hardwired to the airport, and it's okay. also got the printer connected to it, the tower. Mm-hmm. What I want to know is, how do I access that printer from the other two computers in the wireless network?
Okay, do you know the IP address of that printer that's being assigned by your home network?
Is it a networked printer? Okay.
Say again?
I do not know
the IP address of the printer, no.
And that's really the problem right there. Okay. Hey, Philip, you know the answer to this one?
Well, there's a different solution than mucking around with the software that I think is pretty elegant. If you get an Airport Express, it's this little device that plugs into the wall. And
right.
it'll find your wireless network, and you
yeah, I know
plug
what
the
that
USB
is.
Port right into that from
well,
the printer.
This is an IP printer, right?
Yes.
This printer is an IP printer, so it's getting its own assignment.
Yes.
Okay. So the real problem is you don't have the IP address, so you can't add it as a printer.
Okay.
Okay, so this is what you do. When you take your machines that are connected to the network via the hardwire, they can
right.
see it through Rendezvous, correct?
I haven't even checked that, but
are they able to print?
Oh yeah.
How are they able to print? You see it come up in a box?
Yeah, it comes up in a box.
Okay.
I've got the printer monitor.
So now you've added your printer on those boxes that are on the local network. What you need
Correct.
To do is you need to look at the settings of that printer and find out if it's being assigned by name or not.
Yes.
Find out the designation of that printer in that system, and then open
yes.
up Terminal and try to ping that same name, and Apple might give you back the correct IP address for that printer. that's being
open
assigned.
Open up terminal and the wireless and the two that aren't connected hard.
No, the two that are connected.
Oh,
the
okay.
two that are connected are going to be able to tell you stuff about that printer that you need for the other ones that aren't connected.
Work open up terminal and ping and the name.
That's right. The other thing to do is you could plug those ones that are wireless directly in, add the printer, and then go back to the wireless, and it might find it for you.
Oh, that's
That
good.
Might be the cheapest way or easiest way. Thank you for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to go... We're going to go now to, I don't know where this call is coming from, actually. Let's see. Yes, from Soquel. Benjamin, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thank you.
You bet.
Just also wanted to thank you guys for mentioning that thing about the hardware with the TVs.
Yeah.
That's really critical.
I think so, too.
So, yeah. What was that website one more time?
Oh, for learning more about how to fight it?
Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The EFF.
Oh, EFF.
.org, I believe.
So, the question I had was... I'm wondering what kind of devices they have out these days for, like, voice recording, like records MP3 or something like that. Like, so you can take voice notes or put together your blog, like, your podcast on the road and then, like, be able to download it to computer and cast it out and so forth.
Oh, so you're like a personal recording device that you can then take to your computer later.
Yeah.
Okay. Philip, you want to answer that?
Yeah, there's tons. Usually you find them, you know, in any of the electronic stores. I actually like to install Linux on iPods, and you can record higher quality audio than what Apple lets you. They only let you record low quality audio, but if you install iPod Linux on a previous generation iPod, you can record audio. But that's geeking out a little bit. The iRiver MP3 player also does good recording. There's an Arcos that does good recording. I tend to like devices that do a lot of different things. But that's just
preference. Yeah, I just purchased the Arcos G Mini XS 200, I think.
Yeah.
Which is their smallest 20 gig with a 1.8.
Right.
I would say the trick is with these portable audio devices is some of them are more geared for that than others, and the microphones aren't so good on some, and the microphones are better on others. And with... You know, I rarely recommend going to like a Best Buy or whatever for electronics, but in a case like that, I found that because they have a pretty good return policy for hardware, you know, trying it out for the day and seeing if you like it, then returning it is usually not a bad idea. But a lot of people I know use the iRiver, I don't know the model name exactly, but you can plug a microphone into it and it works out pretty well apparently, and you've got, you know, gigs and gigs of storage to record.
I think one of our geeks owns an iRiver, Digital River.
He does a good job.
Like
he likes
that.
It quite a bit.
He's very pleased.
I have to buy some for the current program that I'm in, some recorders. And here's one that I'm looking at. You do a Google on PMD660. It's a portable solid-state recorder. It's definitely high-end. It's going to be like $500 or $600. But it will give you everything you need to do. And, again, that's the PMD660. I think it's from D&M Professional. In any case, take a look at that because that's if you want to spend some money, that's where we're going to go on it, I think. You have one more question for us?
Yeah.
I
was just wondering if anybody is doing any development on, like, for devices like that, of having, like, an audio naming system. So, like, if you were speaking into a device and you simply said, like, you know, Project 6, Day 14, and it would automatically, like, put it under a file of that name or something like that.
I don't know of one, but it's a great thing to make, I think.
Yeah, I think what needs to happen is devices need to get smarter. And luckily, you know, everyone's always trying to figure out different features so they can charge us more money. I actually think, you know, some simple voice recognition might come soon. The processors are getting faster and smaller, and so I think we might see something like that. That is a challenge. Anytime you start recording a lot of audio, you have to become your own kind of file management system, and there's all sorts of different ways that people save their files on their hard drive and upload them and, you know, for podcasts and everything, but it'd be great to have you know, a little bit of a head start and have some smarts in with the MP3 player. The other great thing would be for the MP3 players to transcribe everything that's inside of it. And so there's a text version, you know, as it's being uploaded, so it can be Googled and searched better. And so I think we'll see that in our lifetimes, but unfortunately right now there's still a lot of you know, elbow grease that you have to put in to get that information.
Benjamin, thank you for the call. We're going to go right off to Fred. Which is probably going to be the last call we're going to take today because of time. Fred from Watsonville, what's your question?
Hi, yeah, I'm using Mac OS X 3, and I was tweaking around with my Firefox browser, and things went all wonky. I lost all of the favorites, and so I went
What were you doing?
I was trying to get rid of. It was actually I can't even remember. It was something a plugin that looked interesting. Called something like Captivate that was supposed to be an intelligent, the intelligent web.
Right. Okay.
Idea.
So
it looked weird.
You had a plug in there, and then you decided to take it out, and something messed up.
I tried to remove it, and everything got messed up. And I tried first just reinstalling the application. That didn't work. Mm-hmm. I tried trashing the PLIST file. PLIST, and then. Restarting, and now what happens is the program will launch, but no browser window appears, and nothing I can do seems to launch a browser window.
Okay. Philip, you want to take a stab at this one?
Well, it sounds like he tried a lot of the things. I mean, besides totally removing Firefox and reinstalling it, that's pretty much the only thing that I think would get you at least browser functionality back.
Yeah.
I did remove the application and reinstall it, but I didn't do a search for every possible thing that had Firefox in the name and remove all those things.
I think the important things to get rid of would be the Firefox application, which is probably in your applications folder, and then in your personal libraries, application support Firefox, or actually it's probably under Mozilla Firefox, delete all those files, and then go into also your library preferences and see if you can find any Mozilla or Firefox preferences and delete those. Now, keep in mind that doing all of this will make sure that you have none of your favorites anymore. So you might want to keep them, just put them somewhere else, and then see if you can use them.
Yeah, I did manage to get the favorites downloaded as a file.
Oh, good. Good. Well, then
I've been able to open that in Safari, and at least I still have that.
Well, that's what I would take. You know, libraries, application support, Mozilla, and then library preferences. You can also look at the root library folder instead of your personal library folder. There might be some stuff in there. Of course, doing a search on Mozilla would probably be the best for finding all the different things. Just be conscious that you are, you know, destroying data that might be useful to you. Good luck on your endeavors.
Okay, thanks.
All right, we're speaking with Philip Tarone from Make Magazine. Make Magazine's on the shelves. It's a wonderful little mag about doing stuff yourselves. I think it would be, I mean, if you got like a teenager who's interested in this kind of stuff, who does some tweaking or some playing, it's not a bad magazine to give them. It's got a lot of information. Got any other little tidbits you want to share with us from the magazine, Philip?
Well, you know, in our toolbox section, we do tons of reviews of all sorts of products and tools that are interesting. We've got a do-it-yourself mobile section on how to get the most out of, you know, the equipment you own in a mobile way. One little tip that I like to that we got in the magazine that's kind of neat is if you park your car at a big, you know, Mega Mart, use your camera phone to take a picture of where you park. You know, how many times have you wasted time actually looking for your car or whatever? You can also use a voice memo on your phone. People never use these features on the phones, and this is a good reason. And I guess the real big thing is, you know, this is still Star Wars week, kind of. We have droids on the cover, and so we have a neat story about people who build their own astromechs, which are R2-D2s and C-3POs, and that is a fun article. We show how they build it and why they do it, and these things are awesome. They're on par with anything that you'll see in any of the movies, and these guys, you know, spend tens of thousands of dollars on building these, and they're amazing.
The pictures are extraordinary. I was shocked when I saw the cover. It's really cool.
This part of these guys, and they're hardcore. I mean, they put AI in their R2-D2s and like, run around their house. I'm like, wow, this is great.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning, earlier in the show, we had Miles Elam and Drew Meyer stayed with us the entire show. And, of course, we had Philip Tarone from Make Magazine. Philip is an associate editor. Knows a lot about a lot of things, has a wonderful online blog about Make Magazine and the things that are being done there. And, Philip, I want to thank you very much for being on Geek Speak today with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'll come back on with issue 03 and hopefully some good surprises in projects in that one, too.
That'd be wonderful. And if you ever get a good, really good interview podcast thing, I'd love to air it as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Philip Tarone is an author, artist, and engineer based in Seattle and is associate editor of Make. He has authored and contributed to numerous books on mobile devices, multimedia, hacks, and he's just a geek extreme, right?
Yeah.
And thank you very much for participating. To those that called in, thank you for making Geek Speak what it is. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection. I've already read that, so I won't read it again. This program is also supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io is available by online calling 459-6301 or going cruise.io.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Muslim shrine. Scores of people were injured near Islamabad. Large crowds of grieving Shia pilgrims took to the streets afterwards, some of them yelling and chanting, "Down with America." Police cordoned off the shrine located about half mile from the U.S. embassy. Protesters marched in Pakistan and other Islamic countries in Asia and the Middle East against the U.S. military's alleged desecration of the Quran at a U.S. prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Closing arguments are scheduled today in California, where a U.S. Navy SEAL is accused of participating in the beating of an Iraqi detainee. Yesterday, the Navy lieutenant took the stand for 4 hours in his own defense. NPR's John McChesney reports.
Lieutenant